Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, fears that terrorists will strike so-called soft targets in America.
Soft targets versus hard targets is the nature of terrorism. Terrorism does not confront directly military targets in the traditional sense of warfare.
An Ohio man arrested for an alleged plot to bomb the U.S. Capitol. The Pope is visiting the Philippines, and Obama promotes boosting the economy by better cybersecurity. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Even before the terrorist attacks by radical Islamists in France, an American historian, military expert, and novelist was warning of the danger of similar attacks against schools, churches, and movie theaters in the United States. The latest book by New York Times bestselling author William Forstchen envisions a horrifying attack on a soft target on American soil. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke to Forstchen about his concern that the United States is an easy terrorist target.
What caused me to write Day of Wrath as a novel of ISIS launching an attack inside the United States was based on what happened in Beslan in Chechnya, Russia, September 1, 2004, when extremists seized a school in the town of Beslan and murdered over 300 children, and there were scores of adults were killed as well in that attack. The scary thing for me was I released the book in August, and as the world now knows, several weeks back in Pakistan, the Taliban launched that exact type of attack against a school in which over 130 children and teachers were killed. I fear the same thing is coming to America.
Why ISIL would go for soft rather than hard targets in America?
Soft targets versus hard targets is the nature of terrorism. Terrorism does not confront directly military targets in the traditional sense of warfare. Look what happened in Canada, Ottawa, in which what are called lone wolf gunmen, in this case a single gunman, attempted to shoot up the parliament in Canada. Let us look, of course, at the current news in France, where terrorists attacked a newspaper office and then seized a kosher deli and then an office outside of town. This is the nature of terrorism. By the definition of the word, to instill terror in its opponent. The best way of doing that, going for soft targets that are poorly defended and have the deepest emotional impact.
So did you offer in your book any recommendations to protect the U.S. from possible attacks by ISIS, like the one that took place lately in France?
It presents a difficult constitutional question and also questions locally and how we look at security and defense in our schools, our synagogues, our churches, and even our mosques in America. We have to rethink security. In America, tragically, we've had a number of school shooting incidents across the last 20 years, ever since Columbine. But we tend to look at those as the lone psychotic teenager going in for vengeance or for whatever reason, shoots a limited number. For example, in Connecticut, 20 children were shot. But over 400 children in that school did survive. That doesn't lessen the nature of the horror of the moment. But we tend to see these issues of school security that way. But look what happened in Pakistan 3 weeks ago, where a team of trained killers were able to murder over 130 children. I believe we have to rethink security at our schools. As we are seeing actually today in France, where school security at schools and also particularly Jewish centers of worship has been stepped up significantly.
Do you fear that Americans who fought with ISIS overseas would come back and carry out some attacks like the ones in France?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, is that not the pattern? The news has come out in recent days that the killers in France had been commuting back and forth. They had trained, apparently, in Yemen. It's estimated that at least 1,000 Europeans have traveled to Syria, Yemen, and other places for training, and several hundred have returned. And that is clearly indicated for some people leaving America for training and returning. It's no secret that there are what are called sleeper cells already inside the United States.
Why do experts believe that ISIS is a more dangerous foe than Al-Qaeda?
ISIS, in its methodology, is somewhat different than Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was a diffused network, essentially working underground, and just prior to 9/11 had established a base for itself in Afghanistan. ISIS is actually bent on territorial acquisition, the declared goal of establishing a caliphate, of erasing borders, which, yes, any historian knows are artificial borders in the Middle East that came out of World War I, without regard to ethnic and religious issues. But ISIS is bent on establishing a caliphate, an actual territory. At this moment, its headquarters are in Raqqa, Syria, but their goal is eventually to seize Baghdad and actually what used to be called the entire Levant. This is a different type of enemy that we are now facing.
Final question, Professor. Is the United States adopting right now the right strategy to destroy ISIS?
No, they are not. We tend to rely too much on our technology. Yes, we have created remarkable and frightening military technology, in particular the drone system, which does not put American lives at risk. Air combat, since its development 100 years ago, has never been precise. There's collateral damage, as it's called. Civilians are killed as well. It's a system that simply is not truly effective. War-weary as we are after close to 15 years of engagement in the Middle East, we have to rethink our strategy. And as the old saying goes, I believe it's going to mean boots on the ground at some point. I disagree with mass mobilization, as we saw in the combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. I do support specialized units going after the terrorist targets.
William Forstchen, military expert, historian, author of the book Day of Wrath, and a professor of history at Montreat College in North Carolina. Federal agents have arrested an Ohio man for allegedly plotting to set off bombs at the U.S. Capitol and shoot employees in and around the building. Christopher Cornell was arrested Wednesday, moments after buying a weapon at a Cincinnati gun store. He was charged in a federal court with weapons possession and attempting to kill a U.S. government officer. According to court documents, Cornell allegedly told an FBI informant that he considered members of Congress enemies. He told the informant he was planning to go to Washington, scope out government buildings for security measures, and set off pipe bombs outside the U.S. Capitol. He also allegedly planned to gun down people around the building. The documents say Cornell believed the attack would show support for Islamic State and that he had been in contact with persons overseas relating to his plot. The FBI says Cornell also had bomb-making and Islamic Jihad videos on his computer. Also Wednesday, a 21-year-old Florida man was given a 20-year sentence for attempting to train and join Islamic extremists in the Middle East. The Justice Department says Shelton Thomas Bell recruited an unnamed juvenile to go with him to Yemen. The pair eventually wound up in Jordan, where they were arrested and deported back to the United States. Meanwhile, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted 236 to 191 to extend funding for domestic security operations, while also blocking President Barack Obama's executive order shielding millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Capitol Hill the bill has little chance of becoming law.
The Republican-led House voted to fund the Department of Homeland Security for the remainder of the fiscal year, something lawmakers of both parties support. But the bill came with amendments designed to prevent the agency from complying with the president's unilateral actions on immigration, as explained by Republican Congressman Bob Goodlatte.
The amendment will completely defund President Obama's unconstitutional power grab, granting deferred action status and work authorization to over 4 million unlawful aliens.
Senate passage of the bill is viewed as questionable, and Republicans do not have the votes that would be required to override a presidential veto. Given this reality, Democrats like Representative Mark Takano are accusing Republicans of playing partisan politics with domestic security.
We just saw what happened to our friends in France, and now they're going to play games with our national security and threaten its funding.
Not so, according to House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who says it is Democrats who imperil the nation by favoring executive action over the legislative process.
This is about resisting the assault on democratic government and protecting the constitutional separation of powers. There's only one question to ask. Do we weaken our Constitution by allowing the executive to legislate, or do we defend the most fundamental laws of our democracy? There is no middle ground.
In the last Congress, the Senate passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill that was never voted on in the House. In issuing the executive order 2 months ago, President Obama said he had no choice but to act because Congress failed to do so. Republican Party leaders acknowledge the need to fix America's immigration system for the good of the nation and their party, which has seen a weakening of support from Hispanics during the past decade. Democratic Representative Luis Gutierrez says Wednesday's House vote will further damage the Republican brand among immigrants.
Your action today will cause only anger and outrage and the mobilization of an immigrant community throughout this nation that will be the death nail to the future of your party as a national institution. That is what you will reap today.
The Department of Homeland Security is funded into next month, while the rest of the federal government has been funded through September. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Ahead of his annual State of the Union address, U.S. President Barack Obama is promoting ideas on how to boost the U.S. economy and improve the standard of living for more Americans. This week, his speeches have focused on the importance of digital technology for consumers and businesses and on ways to protect confidential information in cyberspace. Zlatica Hoke has details.
Speaking to an audience in Cedar Falls, Iowa, Wednesday, President Obama said the U.S. economy is growing stronger, and he wants more Americans to feel that resurgence in their daily lives.
And in the 21st century, in this age of innovation and in technology, so much of the prosperity that we're striving for, so many of the jobs that we want to create, depend on our digital economy. Depends on our ability to connect and to shop and to do business and discover and learn online in cyberspace.
In order to succeed, the president said, Americans in many communities needed faster and cheaper access to broadband.
It's about giving the entrepreneur, the small business person on Main Street, a chance to compete with the folks out in Silicon Valley or across the globe. It's about helping a student access the online courses and employment opportunities that can help her pursue her dreams.
On Monday, the president unveiled plans to strengthen laws against identity theft by requiring businesses to inform consumers within 30 days if their information has been hacked. The plan also would criminalize companies selling consumers' data overseas.
This is a matter of public safety and of public health. And most of this infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector. So neither government nor the private sector can defend the nation alone. It's going to have to be a shared mission, government and industry working hand in hand as partners.
Privacy advocates have criticized the idea of data sharing between companies and the government following the discovery of U.S. government surveillance and bulk data collection. But some analysts note that many companies share customers' personal data without their knowledge or consent.
There are no real privacy laws regarding online browsing, regarding an awful lot of other information like health information, like financial information. That data is often passed on to advertisers, to insurance companies in an unlimited way. You and I don't actually know what data exists. We don't know what information about us these companies and the data brokers have.
Lattice notes that Mr. Obama's plans may encounter opposition from some lawmakers.
Considering the majority balance in the new Congress, I think the likelihood that the bill is not going to pass is fairly high.
President Obama expressed confidence Tuesday after meeting with a group of lawmakers that a compromise will be reached, as it is in everyone's interest to protect U.S. economy from cyber attacks. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Pope Francis is in the Philippines for a five-day visit, keenly awaited by the nation's 80 million Roman Catholics. A huge crowd was on hand to welcome the Pope, who was greeted by Philippine President Benigno Aquino as he got off the plane. We asked reporter Simone Ordine in Manila what is on the Pope's agenda.
primarily this trip is for him to visit the survivors of that powerful typhoon that struck the Philippines at the end of November, and also victims of other disasters, to meet with the poor. The other big disaster that happened was the earthquake. It was a 7.1 magnitude earthquake that hit 3 weeks before the typhoon did, and it was in the same general area of the Philippines, the East Central Philippines. So he had been wanting to come to the Philippines ever since those two disasters hit. So that's really the main goal of this trip. But obviously, this is a pope who really is an advocate for the poor in this country, having quite a high poverty rate. Well, is going to meet with quite a few groups of poor. Tomorrow he'll be having a meeting with poor families at a big arena.
In light of the terrorist attacks in France by the Islamist extremists, is the Pope going to take this opportunity to try to reach out to the Muslim community as well?
Well, that's what the Muslim community is hoping. And they're from the region of the Philippines, the southwest in Mindanao, where there is a newly appointed cardinal. He's been in his position for not even a year, and this cardinal was appointed by Pope Francis, who has been a strong advocate for peace with the Muslims. His area includes the stronghold of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, which is the largest Muslim rebel group here in the Philippines that is in the middle of working out a peace deal with the government. They're trying to finalize the terms of that peace deal. So they're really hoping that the Pope will come up with a statement of support for their cause, for this deal. What is hanging in the balance right now with the deal is to get it passed in Congress. So they're hoping that once it's passed in Congress, it would create the autonomous region that the Muslims want. It's a basic law that would create that autonomous region and really get the ball rolling on peace happening or progress happening in this area that had been devastated for almost 40 years of conflict. So a few of the Muslims I spoke with really want the Pope to make some kind of statement about that, and they feel that there's a strong chance he will, because even their cardinal, the cardinal in their region, has been such a strong advocate for peace.
What is the general feeling there about the Pope's visit? Is everyone excited?
Yes, they are. I just came back from the first drive-through that the Pope did, which there are going to be several of those. They have cordoned off lots of sections of Manila's roads because they want, in quotes, maximum exposure for the people. And the people are just so excited. I mean, I talked to a few people who said, I only saw his back, but I feel so blessed. You know, that was what they were thinking, because he drove through so quickly. I mean, I was trying to catch him with my camera and I couldn't get it because it just, like, he literally flew by in a matter of seconds. But people were still really excited just to see him and be around where he was.
Reporter Simone Orendine speaking with us from Manila. The pontiff's visit to the Philippines is the first since Pope John Paul's in 1995. Pope Francis is traveling to the Philippines from Sri Lanka, where he called for unity in the conflict-hit nation and canonized its first saint. On Wednesday, the Pope called for unity and forgiveness during a sermon in Sri Lanka's war-torn north. Tens of thousands from across the country's religious and ethnic divide gathered at the Our Lady of Madu Shrine to hear his message. Rebels unsuccessfully fought a 25-year civil war for independence in the Tamil-dominated north. Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen marked his 30th anniversary in power Wednesday. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch urged the international community to demand human rights and democratic reform. The rights group says for 30 years, Hun Sen has been using political violence, repression, and corruption to remain in power. Hun Sen was appointed prime minister January 14, 1985, at the age of 32. The former Khmer Rouge commander heads the ruling Cambodian People's Party, CPP. He is now the sixth longest-serving leader, just behind Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Most Cambodians today have known no other leader. In 2013 elections, the ruling CPP won just 68 of 123 parliamentary seats, with the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party, CNRP, capturing 55. Southeast Asian analyst Carl Thayer tells VOA's Victor Beatty Hun Sen's legacy is, at best, mixed.
He gets some credit for not allowing communist ideology to lead to draconian social policies, particularly after the Vietnamese left. So he brought about a period of stability. But then from the moment the 93 UN-sponsored elections were held, and he didn't win, he refused to step aside. But then the UN regulations required a two-thirds majority, so he formed coalition governments. From July 97 onwards, the second aspect, where he gets credit for stability and holding Cambodia together and dealing with the Khmer Rouge threat, then gets replaced by a person who is a minority partner in a coalition government that gradually begins and wins larger and larger majorities. And through that period, the coalition government crashed because of a coup, a so-called coup in 97, where he used violence and brutally murdered some of the opposition and forced political leader Norodom Ranariddh abroad. And we've had a series of episodes, throwing grenades into an opposition rally that's never been resolved, through to actions of impunity at election time, where government officials can kill journalists and opposition parties. And none of that has been corrected. So he stands as a person who, 30 years in power, bequeathed a liberal democracy and a constitution, has failed to bring about the promise of that constitution, creating an independent press. He suppressed that largely, creating an independent court system, and bringing about a rule of law. And in 2013, there was a surge of reaction against him. And I think it's because, like other long-serving leaders, and I liken him to Suharto of Indonesia's new order, he's perhaps gone one election too far. He should have planned for retirement. And although he was the youngest, I think, at the time he took over, he's no longer that, and he served too long. And impunity, protecting himself, his clan, his patronage network is prime, and I unfortunately think not Cambodia, not the institutionalizing a liberal democratic system which the Constitution provided for.
At 62, he could potentially have a long way to go.
Absolutely, but like Suharto, I think that over time that I am the regime is become Hun Sen, that he wanted to stay on to 74. Being much older than that myself, of course, I don't like age discrimination, and he could serve. He's done some good things. I mean, the economy is kicking along fine, and as I say, he's balanced relations between China and Cambodia. But he's expelled Uyghurs, asylum seekers, and he's expelled in the past Vietnamese ethnic minorities from the islands. And this, in a country where they've overcome the Khmer Rouge, you would expect a kind of sympathy and support for human rights because they were totally absent under the Khmer Rouge, and he defected from them and helped fight for their overthrow. But, I mean, his legacy, when we balance it, is to have undermined the democratic system that Cambodia was given, to humiliate the opposition, to use electoral fraud. And then what Human Rights is charging is that there are these unexplained killings, motorbikes driving by and shooting someone, opposition politicians killed during election campaigns. No one found guilty. So it's a culture of impunity as long as you have Hun Sen's backing. He's going to have to live with that. And whether he could stay on for a longer period of time will be tested electorally in commune elections and eventually in national elections. And now he's got a real fight on his hand because the opposition has shown in the 2013 elections that he's no longer the person that could command such an absolute majority of support from the national population.
Thayer says both internal reform on elections, the police and judiciary, and outside pressure in the form of conditional aid and supporting those political leaders who stand for the rule of law will eventually bring about change. He says in the wake of the 2013 elections, even members of the ruling party are beginning to realize a transition process must begin. Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can re-listen to our program there, too. Okay. Different kind we get.